TGIF. Am I right? Let's review the economic week that was, shall we? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Rima Reis in for Kai Rizdal. It is Friday, the 13th of August. Good to have you along. You know, we are just going to dive right into our weekly wrap. We've got about 6 minutes to talk about the latest on everything from infrastructure to inflation. And here to do it with me is Sudeep Reddy from Politico and Kate Davidson from The Wall Street Journal. Hey, you two.
Hey, Rima.
Hey, Rima.
So it was a big week in D.C. The Senate approved the $1 trillion bipartisan infrastructure bill, which was a big step. And now it needs to pass in the House. But House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said, hold up. No, we're not going to go there until the Senate passes a second bigger $3.5 trillion budget bill that focuses on expanding the country's social safety net. Sudeep, what do you think happens next here?
It's a giant juggling act between the House and President Biden and Senate leaders on how to actually ram this thing through and keep the moderates happy from among moderate Democrats, keep the progressive left happy, keep Republicans in the Senate from at least the 19 who voted for the infrastructure bill from pulling back. Mm-hmm. These are two pieces of legislation. One is the $1 trillion infrastructure plan that moved through. The other is a $3.5 trillion American, as Biden called it, the families plan to support on all sorts of other fronts, the soft infrastructure, as they call it. That's a lot of policy support that's going to be coming through. And there are a lot of people who are trying to latch onto it, to add on to the Christmas tree. And that's a really hard thing to get through Washington these days.
Well, yeah. I mean, Kate, with all this back and forth, do you expect either of these bills to become law anytime soon?
I think that they will, because as Sudeep said, you know, there's, as you pointed out, there's Republican support for this bipartisan infrastructure bill. I think there's a lot of support and momentum behind that. It's just a matter of when and how to kind of fit all the puzzle pieces together. So you have the two big bills, and then you also have, you have to fund the government. They go through this every year, and it seems like we always forget, oh yeah, it's September again. At the end of September, it's the end of the fiscal year. We have to, you know, Congress has to pass a bunch of spending bills, appropriations to fund the actual government operations. So they have to do that. And that's always somewhat contentious. And then this year, I think we're going to talk a little bit about the debt ceiling and they have to figure out how to raise that. So there, it's just a matter of kind of how to line up all of these steps. So I think that some of it we might not see actually getting done until November.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So let's talk about that debt ceiling. So, okay, so Republicans are not keen on this $3.5 trillion budget bill. And now they're like, listen, Democrats, you want to spend this much money. Now you've got to figure out what to do with this debt ceiling, because Congress missed its deadline to either raise or suspend the debt limit, right? And you've been covering this, Kate. What is the latest with that?
Right. So when we're thinking about the $3.5 trillion measure, Democrats are hoping to advance that through a process called reconciliation, which I think everyone, most people, certainly those of us in Washington, have become more familiar with. It basically allows them to do it without any Republican support. They just need a simple majority vote. And so Republicans, you know, they don't tend to not like voting for the debt limit increase, even though it doesn't authorize new spending. It just, you know, they're generally kind of opposed to the country taking on more debt. So it's not an easy vote for them. So they're saying, look, Democrats, if you're going to go through the reconciliation process, you don't need us. You can add this to the reconciliation bill and take care of it yourselves. Why don't you go ahead and do that? You really don't need our support. But Democrats are kind of holding firm to this view that, look, all of us have contributed in one way or another, whether it was the Republican tax cuts in 2017 or these two big bipartisan budget bills that were done during the Trump administration. Mm-hmm. That has contributed to rising deficits and higher debt. And so Democrats are saying, you know, we want this to be a bipartisan vote, a recognition by both parties that it's important to lift the debt ceiling. It's kind of unclear how they're going to resolve that, but that's where it stands right now. And I think they won't really figure out what to do about it until probably mid to late September, when it becomes a bigger issue, when the government is going to be, the cash reserve is going to be dwindling, and they really need to sort this out, or they could risk a default on government debt.
Right. Which hasn't happened before, from what I understand. So
no,
odds are they'll reach a compromise.
I think all, you know, I think all of us who've covered these fights, Sadiq certainly is familiar with them too. I mean, I think all of us are saying, look, they're going to come together. They're going to figure this out, some way to resolve this. But it can be kind of, markets can get kind of skittish around this. I mean, they'll shrug it off for a while, but as we get closer and closer to that deadline, people start to get a little bit antsy about how this is going to work out. So it's not a great thing. I think there's people who would prefer to see the debt limit abolished altogether because they see it as an exercise that's not really that helpful. It's just kind of a lot of brinksmanship. But in the end, right, they've always sorted it out. They probably will this time. But there might be a little more drama this time.
Yeah, well, there already is a lot of drama. All right, Sadiq, so this would not be the weekly wrap without talking about what Kai refers to as the I word. Let's talk about inflation. So the Consumer Price Index came out this week, which gauges inflation. How did this help or not help the Fed Chair's argument that this inflation is transitory?
Well, there are certain elements of it that we certainly know are due to the pandemic, that, and we still have those factors. And if you focus on the pandemic-related supply disruptions and the things that were held down before, that is what's still driving a lot of the inflation. But there are other components of it that are gonna start challenging the Fed Chair Powell's narrative here. Rents are rising across the country. Obviously, housing prices have been soaring. All of that is going to create some problem going forward. But again, like we now have this resurgence of COVID fears across the economy,
right,
and with people kind of getting a little jittery about the Delta variant. And that runs the risk of actually pushing inflation back down. And so you've got these competing forces colliding in this very unusual moment when we thought we'd be coming out of the worst of the storm, and we're going into a little mini storm right now.
Yeah.
And so that will create a lot of cloudiness in the inflation gauge.
Yeah. The dark, awful cloud of the Delta variant. All right, Sadiq Reddy is from Politico. Kate Davidson is from The Wall Street Journal. Thanks, you two.
Thank you.
Thanks, Rima.
On Wall Street today, finished up, but barely. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Consumers are not happy. That's according to a report out today from the University of Michigan. It tracks how consumers are feeling with its Consumer Sentiment Index. And after falling pretty hard in July, the index plummeted in early August, falling more than 10%, down to its lowest level in a decade. The report said that the losses in early August were observed, quote, across all regions, from personal finances to prospects for the economy, including inflation and unemployment. So, yeah, it's a bummer. And as Mitchell Hartman reports, the reason behind a lot of those feelings have to do with those coronavirus variants.
Along with rising prices and unemployment weighing on consumers, there's the latest surge in COVID cases, hospitalizations, and deaths, says University of Michigan survey director Richard Curtin.
Consumers have correctly reasoned that the economy's performance will diminish in the next several months due to the Delta variant. The emotional part has to do with dashed hopes that the pandemic would end soon.
And consumers are voting with their feet. Megan Winterstein at ZenReach, which measures foot traffic to stores and restaurants, says consumers rushed out when mask recommendations and mandates were lifted earlier this year. But in many places, as they've been reimposed,
over the last month, we've really seen things start to flatten and even decline.
Consumer surveys also show people are now more hesitant to travel and socialize. And who's gotten most worried lately? Chris Jackson at polling firm Ipsos says it's people who have been vaccinated.
You know, it is the vaccinated who continue to be most attuned to what's going on with the pandemic. Maybe they themselves are taking a step back, less time in restaurants and whatnot. And the unvaccinated just don't care as much about the coronavirus, so they're just not responding.
Consumer sentiment has fallen more for vaccinated than unvaccinated people in recent weeks. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
If you ever miss a day of Marketplace, well, I'm sorry. But do not fret. You can catch up on all the day's economic news with our podcast, available on the platform of your choice. So we talked a bit about this on the show yesterday, how the U.S. Census Bureau released a bunch of new data. And one of the more interesting things that stuck out to us was the data about where people are living. It turns out the vast majority of us, about 86% of us, live in cities and their broader metro areas. Over the last decade, population in those areas grew by 9%. So what do these numbers mean for the economy? Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has that one.
To see why these numbers matter, especially for rural communities, look no further than the infrastructure bill. Members of Congress will likely look to census data to determine where the money should go.
For building roads and having influxes of resources for community economic development, not the least of which is broadband.
Jane Kolodinsky runs the Center for Rural Studies at the University of Vermont.
But if we expand to include things like childcare or community health centers and so on, we will see a change in the amount of resource that reaches rural areas.
At the same time, says Peter Haslag of Vanderbilt University, when it comes to this particular batch of numbers gathered just as people were moving all over.
I take it with a grain of salt because we did see these huge shifts in migration patterns following the onset of the pandemic.
Those moves may not show up in this census, but they are showing up in other measures, says Robert Dietz with the National Association of Home Builders.
Just as we have seen in the construction data and some increases in those outer suburb home building projects, we have seen additional growth over the last year in those rural markets.
Dietz says the 2020 census does capture longer-term demographic shifts, but in terms of where Americans are living now, we probably need a bit more data. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Coming up,
to achieve the goals that we've set out to achieve.
All things football. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones was little changed, adding 15 points to close at 35,515. The NASDAQ also didn't do much, picking up 6 points to finish at 14,822. The S&P 500 tacked on 7 points, 0.1%, to end at 4,468. Research firm Morning Consult says for the first time in about a month, it's seeing a decline in the number of people it classifies as vaccine skeptics. Pretty small drop, though, from 30% of people surveyed who are uncertain about or unwilling to get their shots to 29%. Disney smashed expectations for its fiscal third quarter earnings. Subscriber growth for Disney Plus was better than predicted, as were revenue and earnings. Shares lifted 1%. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.28%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Rima Khreis. Over the last year or so, I'm sure you've seen one of these videos on social media. I'm talking about clips of airline passengers or customers at grocery stores basically lashing out, being disruptive, yelling, or even assaulting employees. A lot of times it's over having to wear a mask. Other times, shoppers are feeling short-fused over slow service. And this is not all just anecdotal. With airlines, for example, so far this year, they've reported more unruly passengers than they have in any full year since they began collecting this kind of data back in 1995. Amanda Mull is a staff writer at The Atlantic, and she wrote about all of this in a recent article titled "American Shoppers Are a Nightmare." She explains how America's ultra-tense political climate, along with the traumas of the pandemic, have created more animosity. Amanda, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So your argument is that, yes, things may be worse now, but consumers being difficult, for lack of a better word, is nothing new. And that, in fact, we were conditioned to be this way. What do you mean by that?
Well, consumerism as an idea is only about 150 years old. And it was created sort of as an outgrowth of industrialization and specifically the second industrial revolution. That really ramped up the ability of corporations to produce products, everything from food to home furnishings, at a really large scale, really efficiently. Before that, most people grew a lot of their own food. They made things in their homes. They sewed their own clothes. But the sort of scaled up production abilities created a need for scaled up sales abilities, which is where you get the sort of culture of shopping that we have now.
I mean, that makes sense. And you wrote that back in the 19th century, people were not a big fan of corporate power, and that department stores had to essentially convince people that shopping benefits the community. How did they do that? How did retailers win people over?
Corporate power was just not popular among people who weren't a part of the ownership class. Mm-hmm. This is also an outgrowth of industrialization. And so what department store owners had to do was convince people that actually they, and not the working class, were the people who had their eye out for the interests of regular people. And they did that in a lot of really creative, really expensive ways. Department stores, they didn't just have shopping. They also had post offices and medical facilities and restaurants and cultural events. Mm-hmm. So they just lavished this growing group of middle-income people with all kinds of perks.
Yeah. Yeah. It sounds like they were treating them more like guests than customers. And I guess when you have a guest, like, what do? You make them feel good. You pamper them, make them feel happy.
Yes. This is the era in which calling customers guests became sort of normal, became a thing that people did. And businesses still do that all the time. I think a lot of retailers especially refer to their customers as their guests.
And in building their businesses this way, you argue that department stores were in essence building something much larger, and that is class consciousness. Can you talk about that?
Yes. During the Gilded Age, as an outgrowth of industrialization, the sort of working class split into two. One of these groups was the production laborers, people who worked in factories, who were trying to go on strike, trying to fight for their labor rights. So you get those people, and then you get this sort of like office worker class. And what department stores did essentially was convince this new growing middle class office worker demographic that they were more like rich people than they were like industrial workers.
Made them feel special.
And they did. Yes, they made them feel special. They made them feel served. They did that through these stores. They provided access to servants, basically. If you were a department store customer, you could sort of like rent a servant for a while, while you were choosing a new scarf or a perfume. Yeah. You could have that access to that feeling of being wealthy and upper class and respected and served.
So I want to end by bringing this back to the service workers. You argue that for them, this dynamic is incredibly taxing and that they're doing a lot of emotional labor. Emotional labor is a phrase we hear a lot now. But what do you mean by it in this context?
Yes, it specifically is designed to talk about people who are at their paid jobs and are required to stifle their own emotional reactions to how they're being treated in order to, in the case of most customer service workers, sort of appease and soothe them. And it's a real skill. I have worked customer service. I've worked at big box stores. Being able to sort of like keep yourself under control in a situation in which people are just losing control at you is really, really psychologically difficult.
Yeah. Amanda Moll is a staff writer at The Atlantic, where you can check out her article titled Pandemic Shoppers Are a Nightmare. Thanks so much, Amanda.
Thank you for having me.
For decades, the business of big money college sports, mostly talking about football and men's basketball, went like this. The NCAA made the rules, conferences and schools cashed the checks, and players got scholarships. But that structure is unraveling. The players have been winning the right to earn money in some ways. And in June, the Supreme Court unanimously decided that the NCAA is subject to antitrust law. Justice Brett Kavanaugh wrote that its business practices would be, quote, flatly illegal in almost any other industry. Marketplace's Andy Euler takes a look at how the changes are playing out for schools and conferences.
On the face of it, student athletes have been the big winners at this point in the challenge to the status quo of college sports. So far, 24 states have legislation on the books allowing players to make money off their names, images, and likenesses. Now, there's no national policy yet, but the NCAA has said that it won't penalize any athletes who sell their rights. Those athletes will now be looking to go to schools that give them the most exposure. And Patrick Risch at Washington University in St. Louis says colleges are now flexing their leverage to give the best athletes what they want.
The major universities, because they are major universities in college athletics, they are going to have more eyeballs on them, whether it's Texas, Ohio State, or in basketball, Duke, in Kentucky, and North Carolina. So they do have a built-in advantage, so to speak.
And at least one of those schools he mentioned made a move to increase its advantage just a few weeks ago. The University of Texas, the biggest moneymaker in college football, according to the Wall Street Journal, along with its bitter rival Oklahoma University, ranked number 7, announced that they will both be leaving their longtime conference, the Big 12, to join the SEC, which just signed a $300 million TV deal with ESPN. That's going to allow that conference to pay its member schools almost twice what the Big 12 paid its members last year. Michael Butterworth is director of the Center for Sports Communication and Media at UT.
I think if you are an institution like Oklahoma and Texas that have the kind of brand equity in college football that they have, they're both in a position to be able to examine these options and essentially choose from the things they might want to do.
But it's not just your Texases and Oklahomas that are trying to cash in. Just last year, more than 10 schools transferred their entire sports programs to new conferences, including 13,000-student Stephen F. Austin State University in Nacogdoches, Texas, which moved on July 1st from the Southland Conference to the Western Athletic Conference.
We're trying to predict the future.
That's Ryan Ivey. He's the athletic director at SFA.
If we choose to make this move, is it going to achieve the goals that we've set out to achieve?
Ivy says his school's goals include increasing awareness in some bigger cities and, of course, the possibility of more money.
Obviously, the opportunity that we felt from a revenue standpoint was there, whether that's through TV contracts or whether that's just through additional ticket sales, you know, donations, those type of things that were going to excite our fan base.
Ivy says changing conferences cost Stephen F. Austin about $300,000. Texas and Oklahoma could end up paying more than $100 million combined to move to the SEC. But Ellen Zavian, sports law professor at George Washington University, says these moves are long plays. And ultimately, she says she wouldn't be surprised to see the largest college sports conferences
walk away from the NCAA, create their own entity, get their own deals done in all aspects, and really negotiate with other conferences a championship.
But that sort of complete realignment would also come with its own set of issues, says Matt Mitten at the National Sports Law Institute at Marquette University.
How do they reallocate rule and decision-making power? How will the schools choose to do that essentially among themselves?
And he says a big question will continue to loom over college sports, even if the NCAA is dissolved. Should college athletes be paid professionals?
I just wonder if their model of amateurism, how much that's going to change.
Because he says colleges don't want to have to pay athletes out of their budgets, even as TV contracts continue into the stratosphere. In Austin, I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out. Mitchell Hartman talked earlier about how a lot of consumers are freaked out about this fast-spreading Delta variant. And according to the job search site Indeed, some companies are feeling pretty nervous too. Over the last month, the share of job postings making it clear that a new hire must be vaccinated has nearly doubled. In all fairness, the total number is still relatively low. In the first week of August, roughly 1,200 postings per million required a vaccination. But back in February, that number was about 50 postings per million. And already, we've seen big companies like McDonald's, Walmart, United Airlines, Walt Disney, saying at least some of their workers need to be vaccinated. Okay, we gotta go, but not before we do some economic context. This piece of news honestly, it just makes me want to cry and give up any hopes of ever owning a home. According to the National Association of Realtors, home prices in the second quarter reached yet another record high. The median price of a single-family existing home jumped 23% from a year earlier. Let me say that again. It is 23% more expensive than last year. Median price is at an all-time high of nearly $358,000. Out of the 183 measured metro areas, home prices rose in 182 of them, The only metro area to post a decline in home prices was Springfield, Illinois, which I guess is where I'm moving to. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fergali. Nancy Cassett is the managing director of news, and I'm Rima Chreis. All right, we'll see you Monday. This is APM.